this is Emily Walker, Vice President of Advocacy for the BSCPA, and I'm here with Patrick Cushing, who's a partner with Williams Mullen and our legislative council as well. And we're here to give everybody an update on what's been going on with the 2019 General Assembly, a little bit on the issues, but really focusing even more, I think, on just the tone and general things that we're seeing that are influencing outcomes at this point in time. So it is Friday, January 25th, and so just want to provide that context as far as some of the issues that we talk about. By the time you hear this, may have moved along to different points in the process, but thought we could start by just giving a really brief update on tax conformity, since that has been our headline issue for this session so far, and it's definitely not moving the way that we're accustomed to seeing it move. I think that's really reflective of kind of the tone and the dynamics of the General Assembly this year. I think this week we saw some incremental progress, which is much better than where we had been previously. But in a normal year, the legislation would be just about to make it to the governor's desk by this point in the session. We're like 2.5 weeks in now, mm-hmm. I think. And none of the bills have gotten a hearing in a committee yet to make that movement. So that's really been a change and a bit of a frustration. So, like I said, we did see a little bit of movement. The House has finally sent at least one of the conformity bills back to House Finance. They had previously put it in Rules, which is a bit of an unusual move. But what that really does is it gave the Speaker control over the timing. And I think that's the gist of why they did that. But there were some compelling floor speeches this week trying to push the issue along, and that was on both sides of the aisle, so that's definitely a positive sign from our perspective, and I think maybe push the issue along to get it moving instead of continuing to have it be stagnant. Do you want to add anything, Patrick?
Yeah, no, and it's, you know, the word hostage has been used on a number of occasions, and certainly the tax conformity bill has been held hostage this year. As many folks know, the changes from the Tax Cut and Jobs Act had some unintended consequences for Virginia, and so there's a number of tax policy changes that the General Assembly is interested in making, that the governor is interested in making, a number of competing proposals. And while we are all for tax conformity and getting that conformity bill passed quickly as a standalone bill, it is being tied to separate bills that deal with tax policy. Those thinking that perhaps this is a point of leverage on one side or the other, and so that's what we're seeing. But yeah, hostage is the word that
definitely,
that we're hearing,
which we're not used to seeing. And I think something interesting that came up this week, I was talking with Walter Stosch about it as well, and he's been working with Patrick and I this session and has been very influential, particularly in the Senate. He still carries a lot of clout with them, and I think he had pointed out, rightly so, that we actually already have conformity. Mm-hmm. It's just not with a current date and not in a way that picks up the changes in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And I've taken a lot of calls from members over the past several months and a few more recently, including emails as well, with members just kind of challenging why the society is choosing to focus solely on tax conformity and getting that date updated, and why we're not really speaking up on these policy issues. We've heard from some of the larger companies about a few of the corporate provisions that are less favorable to businesses. Everybody's heard a ton about this issue with itemization and the changes to the standard deduction and how that impacts the individual taxpayers. And I think it's been a really tricky path for us to navigate as an organization. But Patrick and I previously talked about how, as a statewide association, we kind of have a responsibility to be careful on some of these policy issues. And we're certainly not unique in that. It's just that at the moment we're talking about taxes, which gets folks really riled up depending on their perspective, their client base, their employer, things like that.
Yeah, and Emily, as you know, I represent a couple of different statewide associations that are professional services oriented. Examples are the American Institute of Architects, American Council of Engineering Companies. I have represented the Virginia Bar Association, comprised of attorneys in the past. And one of the things that I always, you know, try to make sure that the associations, in this case, the professional associations I represent, is that the political capital is reserved for those issues that are core and fundamental to the practice of accounting, the practice of architecture, the practice of engineering. And so when looking at bills that move in one policy direction or another, from the association perspective, we rely on individual members. If there is a policy that they want to support, whether they are an in-house accountant, in-house architect, and something really impacts their firm or their client base, they are free to move out and pivot on those big policy initiatives. But when it comes to speaking on behalf of an entire statewide association, we have limited political capital, and we want to expend that where it is critical to the practice of accounting.
Right, and especially when we're looked at generally as a relatively neutral party, and now that I said party, I'm kind of laughing at myself, but a neutral contributor maybe is a better way to say it. And we don't typically align with one party or the other on the issues. So we want to maintain that image of being a neutral partner in the discussion and not being partisan. And I think that is really coming to light this year as you look at which policy changes each camp has lined up behind. If we were to throw our hat into the fray, it could seriously damage relationships with members of the party that's not in support of that particular initiative. And when we look at what could happen with the upcoming elections for next year's General Assembly, that could have a devastating long-term consequence if we're perceived as being a partisan organization when we've worked very hard to be a bipartisan or even nonpartisan organization. So I think that's just important to reiterate as we navigate these really challenging changes.
Yeah, and that's right, Emily. And I think what makes it difficult is you have the Democrats and the Republicans, generally speaking. Of course, there's some differences between the House, the Senate, and the governor's office, but the flags have been planted in very different locations, and there is a wide chasm between those flags, and it doesn't leave really the ability for us to say one way is going to be better than the other. We don't want to jeopardize our ability to sit down with leadership from both bodies, and we don't want to take any attention away from the fact that if you don't pass a conformity bill quickly for 2018, there are going to be significant consequences among the accounting industry, among primarily the taxpayers that mm-hmm. will not be able to file taxes. And that's
or if they do, they're going to have to file amendments.
Right.
They're going to,
right.
You know, so
yeah.
you're adding to the cost of compliance, the complexity of compliance, and not every taxpayer even uses a practitioner.
Right.
And so you're making it harder for those individuals that choose to file their own taxes to be able to do so and understand what they're doing. So that's a challenge, and that's really what we've been faced with on that issue this year.
The other thing that comes to mind, Emily, is as we sit down with legislators from both sides, in leadership, rank and file, whoever, during the legislative session, we have limited time.
Right.
It's a short session. When we walk into an office, we know we have 5, 10, 15 minutes at the most, and you know, we are advocating, we are an advocacy group and looking to promote quick action on conformity, but what's happening is we are spending a tremendous amount of time simply educating.
That's true.
Educating on what conformity is and what conformity isn't. the number of times that I have read on Facebook posts by legislators, news articles, op-eds that we should conform to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act and we should double our, and that means doubling our standard deduction.
Right.
And so with a lot of these legislators, now we've been touching the leadership and those key thought leaders in each body significantly, so we feel that they are educated at this point, but outside of the core leadership and those involved in the core discussions, when we meet with folks, legislators, we are spending most of the time just educating.
We are, and answering questions, and even their staff,
yes.
Actually. I had the opportunity earlier this week to talk with the Senate Democratic legislative aides. They have their own meeting weekly and talk about what kinds of constituent questions and calls they're getting and what challenges they're facing in supporting their legislators. And so they invited me to come and talk to them about tax conformity, and it was very insightful to hear their questions. And they were asking me when I thought, like, did I have a date for when something was going to happen, and I didn't, other than to say it's way behind where it would typically be. But even just hearing from them what they're hearing, the questions they're getting, and kind of wondering how to respond to the constituents. So it's definitely been a totally different world this year on a lot of fronts. But on a positive note, I think Virginia legislators probably know more about tax conformity now than they ever have in the past, because it's been so routine. Mm-hmm. That I think we've made some strides in terms of educating them about what it is, why it's important, and I don't know, maybe setting the stage for revisiting whether fixed state conformity is the right long-term solution for Virginia, because we certainly don't want a future situation where there's an opportunity to hold it hostage for other negotiations. And some of them have nothing to do with tax. So that's kind of the other dynamic here that we're not used to having to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah, the idea of going back to rolling conformity is something that, you know, Emily, you and I have seen some eyebrows raised, and we've mentioned it at the end of meetings, saying, you know, mm-hmm. if we flipped the framework and said we're going to roll conformity automatically, but if you want, then you can introduce a bill with an emergency clause which requires 80% vote to be retroactive, and if you're something you want to deconform, you still have that bleeder valve mm-hmm. available, but let's not let this get in the way again of significant policy conversations, because that's
right.
What's happening.
That is true. It's yeah. It's interfering in the necessary policy conversations. If conformity had been dealt with sooner, they could focus on the policy mm-hmm. and hammering out a deal on the policy. And they're right now, it's just all bottlenecking and interfering with each other instead of adding clarity to the conversation. So. That has been interesting. I think some who maybe in the past would have turned their nose up at the idea of rolling conformity are kind of realizing that there's an argument to be had there and some rationale for why that moving forward might be a better solution for Virginia. So we'll see. This year is definitely not the year to do it, but I think it sets the stage well for future conversations. So we'll definitely be keeping on that. So let's pivot a little bit to talk about some of the other things that we're seeing at the General Assembly. We focus so much time on conformity and taxes that I don't want members to think that we're not doing anything else.
Right.
So I think probably one of the bigger ones that we've already made some strides on, but there's still a few pending pieces of legislation out there that we're going to have to speak up on, relates to procurement law, which is a new area for me, but not so much for Patrick. So we've identified a few pieces of legislation that if they were to pass, definitely is introduced, but even some of them, if anything along the lines of what was introduced passed, could be really problematic for accounting services that are contracted for by state and local governments in Virginia.
Yeah. Yeah, Emily, one of those, I know that we've successfully defeated this bill this year, that on the procurement front, what's interesting with the Procurement Act is professional services, that's law, dentistry, medicine, accounting, architecture, engineering, and a couple of others, are procured very differently than how you procure pens and pencils, goods, which is competitive sealed bidding, so lowest price wins. That's because you know I need a number two pencil, whoever can give it to me for the lowest price wins. It's good for the taxpayers. On the professional services front, it's different because it's a qualifications first process where an entity, a public entity that wants to procure a professional service like accounting, put out an RFP, maybe for, in this case, an audit, and the RFP says, well, we're going to need an audit of our books in some form or fashion, and the proposals that are submitted by accounting firms would be focused primarily on the qualifications of that accounting firm and doing those specific types of audits. The way the process works is the public body is required to rank the most qualified firm to the least qualified firm, and then engage in negotiations on price with the most qualified firm. But price does not come into the discussion until you have ranked the firms, and you can only negotiate with one firm at a time. If you don't agree on a price, you go to the next firm. Well, there was a bill this year that would seek to introduce price much earlier into the conversation, allowing a discussion on both qualifications and price. Now, the problem with that from the professional services world is if you have a highly technical area of accounting or law or dentistry or medicine that needs the most qualified entity, by introducing price, you have taken away the focus on qualifications. You've potentially right. jeopardized the service. And so that's something that we always keep an eye on for in the architecture and engineering profession. It also applies in the accounting profession. And I know, Emily, you had mentioned that there are some high-risk audits in particular that really need for public entities to focus on getting the most qualified firm
right.
Through that process.
Absolutely. I mean, we do see a lot of audit failures, particularly in government auditing, which any audit that's procured by the state or by a local government is going to be subject to government auditing standards. And so it definitely is important that they're the most qualified possible in order to fulfill that, you know, making the best use of taxpayer dollars. And I think what was also concerning to me when I looked at those bills was they didn't appear to have anything within them to ensure that if they were to say, look at the top two qualified, that they were substantially equal
right.
in qualifications. And so you could have an extremely well-qualified firm that ranks at the top, but the number two could be, you know, nowhere near in the qualifications, and the way that these bills were written, it would have allowed simultaneous
right.
price negotiation with both of them at the same time, and that it does take the focus away from being qualifications based. So I think that was good that we were able to identify that early and take care of it, plant mm-hmm. some questions with some of the committee members to make sure that they knew exactly what the impact of those changes might be. So, and then there was another one that we're still working on that basically prohibits a contractor from working on premises of the agency mm-hmm. that procures their services. And so that one was perplexing, definitely from the accounting perspective, but I would imagine some others too. You know, it's virtually impossible to conduct an audit if you can't spend at least part of the time on premises.
Yeah, we're not exactly sure where this bill came from, although I think, Emily, you had heard that it was something that had popped up in the Attorney General's office where maybe perhaps it was an attorney or mm-hmm. some other profession that needed to be on premise for an extended period of time and was offered some office space so they didn't have to just stand in a corner and do their work.
Right.
And so we're not quite sure where this bill came from. We've talked to the patron. We understand that there may be either significant amendments to the bill or that the patron may strike it, but we've certainly shared our concerns with
right.
how you would practically implement that and all of the great reasons why you might want to have in this case, an accounting firm, an audit team, be able to work on premise
right.
at a state agency.
Certain steps that you can't take if you're not on premise, though. That was an interesting challenge. And I think it demonstrates, too, something that we see a lot of where a legislator gets wind of something that they don't like that occurs sometimes within state government. And sometimes it's totally unrelated to government work. So it certainly is not unique to procurement law, but in an attempt to fix one very specific or sometimes even isolated problem, they write this broad piece of legislation that has just a ton of unintended consequences that they couldn't possibly have foreseen when they thought this would fix their problem. So that's a big part of what we do, and I think we probably don't talk about it enough, is we do watch legislation even that we wouldn't ordinarily comment on to make sure that it's not placing inappropriate requirements on CPAs that would, for example, cause a violation of professional standards or conflict with Virginia's accounting laws. So that's, it's something that we kind of do quietly. We usually tend to try to talk with patrons before the bills even have hearings and hopefully negotiate an amendment. And then we often don't need to speak on it publicly in committee, because as long as they address our problem, 9 times out of 10, we don't really have input onto the substance of the bill or what it's trying to accomplish. We just want to protect the CPA profession from being put in positions that are inappropriate for them.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see where bills come from. The bill that we just mentioned, prohibiting professional services contractors from working on premise of a state agency, that something had popped up in the Attorney General's office that this delegate thought was inappropriate. But there's all different places that bills come from. Another one that we're keeping an eye on is one that would require any professional services firm that contracts with a public agency to purchase software that would track every action on a computer that the contractor does for the state agency. And so we're curious as to, where does this bill like this come from? So we met with the patron and found out that the delegate has a constituent who owns a company who happens to sell one of the only software packages that would comply with this bill.
Right.
It seems very self-serving, because it is, but this would be a tremendous challenge and cost to any professional service firm. And by the way, this is not something that state agencies have asked for.
Right.
All kinds of cybersecurity issues and concerns. Every keystroke would be logged. Every click, every web page visited while doing work for a public agency would be recorded and retained for 7 years for future audit purposes. And it's not a bill that practically the professional services world could implement. It's not something the state is asking for. It is coming from a constituent who hopes to make a ton of money if this bill were to pass.
Right. Well, and the other interesting thing there, because I've talked with some of our members who do a lot of government contracting work, and apparently at the federal level with some of the bigger firms, this is not uncommon, except the agency provides the software, and it's generally proprietary, and it's not at a cost to the contractor. So they're not being required to purchase and install something for the benefit of the government in that case. So, my comment to Patrick when we were trying to talk through what are we going to do with this bill and how are we going to navigate it through the committee process and working with the patron and whatnot was, it seems like this should be the reverse. Like if there's a sense that Virginia needs to look into having this kind of accountability, then shouldn't there be a procurement process that the state goes through to find a vendor that would provide this software to the state, and then the state could require as part of the contract that it be installed, but it wouldn't, it shouldn't be at the cost of the vendor.
Yeah.
Or the contractor in this case. So it seems like that in and of itself should be going through its own procurement process instead of being legislated.
Yeah, and so Emily, when we talk about focusing on those policy issues that are core, that, that impact the core practice of accounting and the work that, that CPAs do for on behalf of all of their clients, these are the types of issues that fall in that bucket of this has a broad impact on how
right.
CPAs practice. And that's where we're really going to use our political capital to weigh in addition to the conformity discussion.
Right. Agreed. I think the one other issue that I wanted to talk about a little bit this morning is regulatory reform. It's been a theme not just in Virginia, but really across the country. We're seeing all kinds of different legislation popping up in every state doing some form of regulatory reform, a lot of it around the idea of reducing regulatory burdens and state legislatures having a better handle on what the state regulatory bodies are doing. So it's manifested in a bunch of different ways. There's several pieces of legislation this year that we're following, which I guess fortunately don't appear to have a direct impact on the Board of Accountancy. They're very focused on the Department of Professional and Occupational Regulation, which of course used to be the umbrella agency that oversaw CPAs, but we've been out from under DPOR for a long time. And that being said, we do watch what is done with respect to that agency, because I think it may be a harbinger of things to come that could impact the broader regulatory community. So we've seen a lot of different pieces of legislation this year dealing with DPOR and their authority, and in some cases it actually expands authority. So like we saw a bill yesterday that came up that will allow DPOR boards to issue cease and desist notices, which apparently are different than orders. So there's some distinction there. And so that looks like that's going to move along just fine. There was another one that was a modification of the Callahan Act, which requires regulatory boards covered by it. And again, the Board of Accountancy is not part of the Callahan Act, but would require the boards to lower licensing fees if it's determined that they're collecting too much money. And there's some parameters set around that, like what kind of balance they can carry as compared to their revenue from the year before, and those sorts of things. But this bill actually, and I believe it passed in the subcommittee unanimously, will require a refund if they exceed that threshold, which is kind of an interesting development. The one thing that occurred to me as I was thinking about it was one of the kind of nuances to state government is it's a little bit hard to plan for the future, right? So as, you know, when you develop a budget, sometimes part of that budget is creating reserves because you want to do some strategic spending for infrastructure upgrades or things like that, and I'm not sure that there's that kind of protection there. So when the state budget appropriates a certain amount of money for each agency to spend on their typical expenses, but trying to plan for longer term projects or expenses where you might need a big chunk of money to put a new system in place that's going to ultimately be better for the regulated profession, or you know, even the tax department, I think, is a good example. They've got some legacy systems in there, and it's hard to save money because of the way the appropriations process works. So that's the thing that I see that gives me a little bit of heartburn as these types of bills move through, is that kind of lack of future vision. Not that I want our Board of Accountancy, as an example, to be able to hoard money away at the expense of licensees, but on the other hand, I do want them to be able to provide the best possible customer service and streamlined experience for licensees, and sometimes that creates a need to make investments. So having a mechanism by which that can happen is probably important. That being said, we're being very careful with commenting on DPOR related legislation because we don't want to draw a lot of attention to the fact that the Board of Accountancy is independent. We don't want to see them get swept back under DPOR because there were problems when they were under DPOR and they weren't able to provide the level of service that CPAs deserve. They weren't able to have an efficient enforcement process, so maintaining that independence is important. So just kind of wanted to mention that those are going on and we are watching them carefully. Anything that comes out that affects DPOR has the potential for certain to be expanded to other agencies within the Commonwealth, which could at some point include the Board of Accountancy. So I think with that, we've pretty much covered everything we've got on the table right now. So Patrick, I want to thank you for your time this morning, and hopefully this is beneficial to everybody who takes the time to listen to this.
Thank you, Emily.